accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing.
To the Funny Ace Wood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island changed nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. And my guest, my very special guest, Blair Anderson, the Mild Green. You can go check out his website, mildgreens.blogspot.com, coming at us live from Christchurch. Blair, what's shaking?
Not much is shaking at the moment, Vinny. It's been quiet for a few days in terms of the geology, but boy, democracy is being shaken. That's for sure, with the usurpation of the governance of Christchurch rebuild. They're falling for the same old trap they do in a lot of places, going for the top-down solution. We know what's best for you.
The shock doctrine solution.
Yep, and it's bloody shameful because it was a good healthy community before the shake, and this is going to make more people run away than the ground moving.
Well, you know somewhat a lot about the Christchurch community, being as you're a former mayoral candidate and what have you, been involved in the political scene for some years. I wanted to kind of get your perspective on just how Christchurch has literally changed how the atmosphere it has changed, particularly in politics and just in daily life since the earthquakes.
Well, it kind of started before the earthquake, when the issue that was dear to my heart, water quality, defined who got into the territorial authority environment, Canterbury, the elections of which occurs during the course of course, our mayoral and council elections as well. It came as a bit of a surprise to a few people that Rick Tindall was successful, and along with his colleague, in Christchurch East. And it didn't surprise me, because I had suggested to Rick that this is where he should run. He was going to run in the western suburbs, because it's the western suburbs of Christchurch, of course, where the aquifers are most affected, being closest to the, as it were, to the source of clean water, which really comes from the Southern Alps. It leaches into our gravel soils, as it were, or a gravel rock structure underneath the Canterbury Plains, as it comes down the Waimakere area and Rakaia rivers. And that's what gives us our 1,000-year-old water. So when I had suggested to Rick that he should run in Christchurch East, that's where the social conscience of Christchurch was, he toppled another good friend of mine, Richard Budd. So I really had set, you know, a cat amongst the pigeons, as it were, with helping Rick get elected there. And it turned out I was right. This was where the social conscience resides. And yet, in an irony of ironies, Christchurch East is the suburb the suburbs that were affected most by the quake. Now, after the Save Our Water campaign was so successful, and the allocation of the various portfolios in the territorial authority were made, Rick found himself heading up the civil defence portfolio. Now, the differences that occurred, the irreconcilable differences that occurred at the table of ECAN, as it's called, Environment Canterbury, centred around water. And that's when the government decided to step in and throw out all the elected members of that governance and replace them with a commissioner. And that had occurred months and months before we had our first earthquake in September. So not only did my colleague Rick lose his income and responsibilities as an elected member, we decided that really the mayor, Bob Parker, should be listened to. When I say we, that the Parliament of New Zealand should be listened to, and appointed a commissioner to look after our interests. Now, well, some people could say, hang on, guys, just let me just sort my dog out here. One moment, I didn't expect that. They've been very quiet up until now. Hang on, just let me just sort them.
Blair's quite the dog buff, ladies and gentlemen. Trust me, you can go to his website and contact him. Have you got any questions about any of your dogs or anything like that? Blair would be the man to ask. He's the man who knows dogs and bitches inside and out.
Back again. I just heard that last comment. The question about dogs also comes into play here, and I'll get to that a little bit as I explore this subject. Once the representative politics was out
Hold on a second. Speaking of dogs, wasn't it Dame Margaret Baisley that took over Ekans?
Yes. I tend to know less about bitches, so I'm not that familiar with her background. I've never met her. She's never represented me.
Well, now she does.
She's about as approachable as, you know, one of those kind of females guarding her young ones.
She's a very Helen Clarkish type person, you know, with the scary teeth, the dead eyes that look like they'd spit roast you if they could, and carve you up amongst the carnivorous family or something like that. You know, predatory.
Well, steer your down eyes, I think, is what I remember of a photograph of her. But yeah, that preceded the earthquake. So then, of course, after the earthquake. It should be remembered we were in the middle of a mayoral election when September occurred. And Jim Anderton, ironically, a serving member of Parliament, decided he would make a good mayor and put his hand up and drew upon his large political following as an MP, large in the sense that he polled marginally less than 5%. The threshold required to qualify for an MMP party allocation. But nonetheless, he drew upon that and was making a fair fist of the mayoral fight. In fact, he was by far the most popular, according to the polls. He was a shoo-in. The earthquake occurred on September the 4th, and everything changed.
In fact, he even said, what was it? The day before the earthquake, Jim Anderton said, there would have to be an earthquake in Christchurch in order for me to lose the election.
Whether or not he said it, it became folklore, and some people had taken it to heart that he had actually said it. Whether he did or not, it was moot. It may have been just a soundbite sort of put into the political dialogue at the time, but it certainly has become folklore that he did say it, and to every extent, true or not, it accurately described what happened, because the fluoro-jacketed incumbent mayor got all the media coverage, marginalised any other issue, including anybody else who was running. There was no political debate. There was no hustings. There was no public meeting.
There was 24 hours a day coverage of the mayor and the Christchurch quake for weeks.
And he tended to do most of it inside the what was known as the cordon, which made him unassailable politically. And while he is trained in media, he surely took advantage of that circumstance.
Was he not a talk show host at one point?
This Is Your Life. It was one of the classic programs in which he had a very visible profile. In fact, he was known as the solid and reliable interviewer of everybody famous, who's famous in New Zealand. But the outcome of the election didn't surprise me. In fact, I wrote on a sign down the road that Jim Anderton had, all his signs had a very convenient black block at the bottom of them, just begging to be drawn on. And I wrote on it in Wynonie Road, just along from me, I said, "God voted for Jim, Bob." So, sorry, God voted for Bob, Jim, get it round the right way. It's lost any punchline it ever had now. But the it pretty much defined what the outcome of that election was, and it's pretty much defined everything that's occurred ever since, because Bob Parker has really done this, from a media perspective, very well. He's kept away from most of the civic debate around what we're doing and what we need to do, and preferred to sidle up to the top-downers that we had to have this as a central government rebuild.
Well, what do you expect from somebody who made a living and made themselves famous off of giving props to people who were already famous?
That's exactly right. That sums it up.
Okay. Know the character of the people you're talking to. Don't just vote for them because you've seen them before and you know their face. Figure out who they are and how they got to where they are. And then you might actually start electing people who actually represent you, because that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to vote for yourself, and you're supposed to find a person that's as much like you as possible. And most people that I talk to aren't ruthless, criminal, sociopathic, financially, fiscally irresponsible, scumbaggery filth. So why should you vote for him? We'll be right back after the break with Blair Anderson. And live, a very special guest, Blair Anderson. Mildgreens.blogspot.com is his website. Phone lines are now open, so if you want to talk about anything related to the anything really, 218-339-8525. Now, we were talking about the politicians in Christchurch, and the fact is, you know that old saying. Now, I think that it's so interesting, all of the elements within Christchurch, the build-up to the earthquakes, and then, of course, we've had Ben Vigen on from the Deadline Gazette talking about the 16 telltale signs of HAARP weaponry being used, or HAARP-like weaponry. So it all seems a little bit too convenient. But that doesn't change the fact that people still have to survive down there. And I had a message from a listener yesterday that people are living in their cars in Christchurch. Blair, are you there?
Yes, I am. Yes, I thought you were going to lead on there. Yes, it's true that people are living in their cars, and you've to actually walk around the areas in which I live. In fact, you probably may not be aware, but I was recently red zoned. So not only my business premises where I train dogs, but also my residence. And while I'll be asking serious questions, not only about whether it's appropriate that I was red zoned at all, fact remains that the red zones are necessary as an area wide repair for those areas that have effectively dropped some of them over a meter. And of course, those areas were already approximately close to the level of the river at King Tide anyway. Sometimes they had surface flooding during extreme events. When I say extreme events, a consecutive rain event in Christchurch could produce surface flooding, and did so quite regularly. But it was only really a question of management, a bit of traffic movement around somewhere else while they cleared the drains, that kind of stuff. But post-earthquake, you're looking at areas that are now effectively below sea level at a high tide. So you can understand why areas needed to be red zoned. Some areas, of course, are red zoned for other reasons. They're under the threat of juries, of rocks falling off the hills, proximal location to very tall buildings that could fall down on top of them and things like that. So they're very genuine reasons. But I'm sitting on one of the old paleo sand dunes of Christchurch, between 400 and 500 years old. It's been a site of Maori occupation here. I found greenstone actually on my land itself, which at a level of about a good 2 to 2.5 feet below the existing level. So there's been Maori occupation on these sand dunes for around 400 or 500 years that Maori have occupied the Kaipoia area. But having said that, the paleo sand dunes were not formed by the river. The areas that were formed by the river, and if you can imagine in your mind's eye how a meandering river forms loops, the inside of those loops are depositions of silts that are laid out by the river, and on the outside of those loops is where the river is eaten into the existing landscape. Now, Christchurch was effectively built on a swamp, but that's a simplistic view of it. What's called the Riccarton gravels form the greater part of the geomorphology under Christchurch. But where the paleo sand dunes are, that was formed by the beach. That was formed by the sea. And for them to exist and still remain here, the river was never here. So it's probably the only solid ground, as it were, in Christchurch. And since February the 22nd last year, the hairline cracks in my lava and plaster walls have got no worse as I look up at them. They look more like spider webs that have been left on the wall. And since February the 22nd, they've got no worse, which indicates to me, after 10,000 earthquakes, that my land has been protecting my house. So I really have this kind of dilemma that you've red-zoned the wrong person, Jerry, and he'll have to come and throw me down the stairs before he's going to move me. So
now, I'm a very cynical and suspicious guy. naturally I assume scumbaggery. I was just wondering, is there any correlations between people's political affiliations and red zoning?
Well, you could well wonder in my case, although I regret to say that the other people red zoned similarly along my sand dune certainly weren't the upstanding characters that politically that I'm known to be. Of course, in 2002, I ran against Jerry Brownlee, so he has been my political adversary on the hustings. And subsequently, I've run against Bob Parker twice. So it shouldn't surprise people to see that Bob and I have a political dissonance, notwithstanding the event that he was chairing around the terrible problem of alcohol in our community. And during the discourse at the town hall, I was heard to have stood up and suggested that serious questions needed to be asked of the chair of this meeting, simply because he'd been knowingly funded by one Mr. Henderson, who developed properties throughout the inner city, on every corner of which there was a alcohol establishment. Bob Parker had asked security to have me thrown out, and it didn't go down well when a QC stood up and was observing what was going on, and actually said to me, "This will be interesting." Security saw the foolishness of trying to throw me out of a public meeting for asking what was a very relevant question. But I don't think that that's the reason why I've been red zoned, and I think that the bigger question needs to be asked: why would you want to red zone somebody in somebody's land who is 3 meters above the road, no further away from services than he ever was, on the argument that my land has moved towards the river? Because if it has, it had to go through several fences and cross a road before it was going to get any closer. The evidence shows that, in fact, my land hasn't moved, despite the fact that they've had 3 attempts at surveying the area. The cadastrals in this particular region were never accurate right from square one. I've been here 22 years, and the evidence that they've got is very shallow indeed. In fact, their own Tonkin and Taylor, the geotech guys that variously have on whose authority they have red zoned, Tonkin and Taylor have told me on 2 separate occasions that my land is okay, and that I should hold my ground. So we'll see what transpires. I don't need this shite in my life, of course, but these things were sent to test us and make us better people.
Well, you know, it's people are like iron, and the hotter the fire gets and the more vigorous that iron gets rubbed, it turns itself into steel.
And that's good advice to anybody, that these things really should be looked at as something that is an opportunity to triumph and learn something from. I mean, I may well lose, Vinny, and that's the reality of the situation. This autonomous kind of machine that they call Sarah has absolute authority, according to some. And they've actually got
Sarah.
People running. Oh, yes.
It's like, when you said it, I just heard Ingsoc.
Oh. you shouldn't miss the, you know, that the if you take the letters, of course, it's hardly, if you pronounce it phonetically, Akira. It's a pseudonym, of course, in that sense. That who is it caring for? I know that along this particular sand dune, there are 3 good quality houses that'll be bowled over for no good reason. But here's the real kind of underlying story behind all that. In order to justify red zoning in those areas that where the damage is so slight, yes, my house has moved, there's no question, and there's cracks across my driveway, but those are cracks that you'd have to be wearing stiletto heels to worry you. My house has moved, but it's an 80-year-old house sitting on a sand dune. It was on the move for 80 years. It just got, a bit of time compression. But subsequent to that, the many earthquakes we've had, and I've been home for pretty much most of them, certainly the big ones back in June of last year. I missed the 23rd of December last year earthquake by 2 hours. I'd just flown out of the international airport, which was subsequently closed by that earthquake, so I escaped that one. But I knew in my heart, as I landed in Singapore and was told by the Singapore Airlines staff that we'd just left a big earthquake in Christchurch, I knew that my house would be undamaged simply because it had survived everything else. And that's perhaps indicative of my confidence that it was a bad decision to red zone me. Having said that, the purpose of the red zone is to be able to restore it into habitable form where possible and turn it into parkland and utility land, for the civic good of Christchurch, where it can't be. And part of that process was really interesting, because I looked at a very substantial piece of land, about 14 acres, it's only several hundred metres from my place, that is existing parkland. It is known as Porritt Park, named after the Governor General Arthur Porritt. But it's the it was the home of hockey, and it had a dual surface international standard hockey stadium. Substantial events around hockey, including the national championships and so forth, had been held there. And it had grounds used in summertime for cricket and in winter, of course, for field hockey. But it was also a great place to run your dogs, because it was formed out of an old remnant of the Avon River, a loop. And, of course, it suffered in the earthquake. And as a hockey ground, it was useless. There's been many shots of it taken from the air and demonstrations of what rolling a ball across the artificial surface looks like. It wanders hither and yonder because of the liquefaction that occurred underneath the artificial surfaces. But because it was a hockey ground, it's surrounded by six-foot-high fences. It's got fabulous lighting all round it. Not that I'd use the existing 230-volt lighting. I'd change it to LED and put solar panels to drive it. I had proposed that it be turned into a international standard dog training and research centre. That these things, if you're going to train dogs in an urban setting, you have to have, first of all, an urban setting. And this represented an ideal one. But when I researched it further, I found that things like the Western Australia School of Public Health and the Built Environment had written absolutely fabulous treatises on this. And the social capital and the well-being that comes from dog ownership accrues not only to those people on the end of the leash, but those people who don't own dogs and even those people who are fearful of them. So Porritt Park, being at the edge of the city's potential, very substantial park land, around the river, I had proposed that this become a dog park, but how could I put it, with the riding that it's not just about Christchurch East and healing what that means for all those people that live in this side of the city. It was for the greater good of Christchurch, because it would be part of the river trails, and trails are the way to manage dogs in a city. Marginalising and othering dogs into those places away over there, which you have to drive to, which they call dog parks, and Christchurch has been an exemplar in putting these in, is the wrong way to manage it. And so what I did about 6 months ago was put in a proposal to turn this into a temporary, and I say that with some caution, because I know that post a tragedy like our earthquake, what is temporary often becomes permanent. But I had proposed it as a temporary use of this, because it didn't require anything much more than a bit of voluntary labour and a couple of ditch diggers and backhoes and so forth to fill the liquefaction and fill the cracks and make sure the toilets were working and replace the existing lighting with, you know, solar efficient lighting, so that we could have a dog park that people can walk around and in and enjoy, but also have a research centre around the value of dogdom in a community, because Christchurch has twice as many dogs per household as Auckland, and three times that of Wellington. We are, in fact, the dog city. And it's a small irony that it was Sir Arthur Porritt who unveiled the border collie at Tekapo, and I would probably chisel into some of the concrete over there the words of his opening speech on the value of dogs, and how the South Island in particular, its wealth rose on the back of the humble sheep-herding border collie. So we have much to honour in terms of our history. It's got a cultural idiom. It certainly recognises the value of our river by allowing people to enjoy it, by allowing them to walk around it with their dogs. But I would put it to you and anybody else that the Avon River boat sheds that were recently torched and, you know, in an arson, that would not have occurred had the City Council and CERA adopted my proposal, even, albeit slowly.
Indeed. Blair Anderson is my guest from oldgreens.blogspot.com. We'll be right back after the break. You can join us in the chat room at theeveningeastwoodshow.com or call in 218-339-8525. That's 218-339-8525. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Eastwood Show. Yeah. Hello, everybody. We're going to expose some scumbaggery.
That's what we do.
My very special guest, Blair Anderson, mildgreens.blogspot.com. We came up with a couple of jokes over the break. Sarah, the wonderful government organization that's in charge of, you know, deciding who's in the green zone, who's in the blue zone, who's in the red zone. It's almost very, I'm not sure which sci-fi chronicle it is. You know, there's been many, but when society's been split up into all of these little zones or whatever, so that the central powers can just keep control over them. I don't know. But that's kind of what it reeks like to me. So the organization that's doing all of that is CERA, S-E-R-A, which stands for Stamp Everybody Red Arbitrarily, as is happening to Blair, who incidentally... is a joke, you know, why is Christchurch like a rock concert? Because it's got Rolling Stones and everybody can't get no liquefaction. And incidentally, Blair literally can't get no liquefaction. He can go, you've had like no liquefaction on your property, isn't that right?
No, not at all. It was unbelievable.
It's not like there's not even so much as a speck.
There was at my front gate, but most of that was deposition from the water. A lot of water come out because of broken mains and things like that. And it was in suspension. And after the water drained away, I got my liquefaction by inundation. It came down the road and left itself on my driveway. And that's the only I was lucky to get to see some. Because it came up on tire prints up my driveway.
Yeah. Well, that's very nice. It figures that when you're campaigning to try and save a city from tyranny or whatever like that, a massive natural disaster will hit you, and instead of the natural disaster being the thing that messes up your property, it's the local council's water pipes.
Yes, that's right. It shouldn't be forgotten that there's another irony in all this, and that even though there was a tragedy at what was known as the Pine Gould Guinness building, one of the companies, of course, that made its money on the back of the, you know, as a stock and station supply company and finance company, it took over the building that a very good friend of mine and town planner, Neil Anderson, worked in. That building was formerly the Christchurch Drainage Board. That building was built literally to house the administration of the organization that was responsible for the draining of the swamp. The area that, of course, was most affected by the earthquake is the swamp areas that were subsequently recovered after that organization ceased to exist. Its responsibility was embedded into ECAN, Environment Canterbury. So there's this kind of almost sort of double entendre, as it were, of irony. The drainage board ceased to exist, the one that had effectively drained the swamps, and then along had come the various administrations that gave resource consent to infill areas that were become most affected. And we wouldn't have a city of Christchurch where it is if it hadn't been for the drainage board. But the land most affected was literally those areas recovered after that organization's demise, to find that the building in which that it was designed and built for collapsed. One of two buildings that were built in the late 60s that collapsed tragically, killing nearly everybody that died in the earthquake. We find that there's another irony, that here we've got all these houses like mine who have protected me perfectly well, that have been red zoned and will just be basically firewood and concrete dust. None of the houses in Christchurch killed anybody. And the sort of the holistic picture that draws is one of all the focus is on the rebuild of the CBD, the new organizational layer put in yesterday by Jerry Brownlee is responsible for the rebuild of central Christchurch. Still, Christchurch East and the tragedy of around 10,000 homes that'll have to be bulldozed, is still not being attended to properly.
10,000 homes.
We're looking at 6,000 now, but we're still looking at, there are literally hundreds of homes still in what we call the green-blue zone that are not red-zoned, but are likely to be assigned by the insurance companies to the demolition heap simply because it's uneconomic to repair them. So you're looking at a total of around 10,000 homes, a complete rebuild.
So they're going to have a mass relocation. No, wait a second. They're going to have to build a heck of a lot of apartment blocks and force people to move into the cities, aren't they?
Well,
can I ask you something? Is there any major construction companies or contractors involved with the central city that have ties and connections to the local government?
Oh, look, all the construction companies have had ties to local government. Anybody who's been of any size have been dependent upon local government and of course, commercial opportunity. It doesn't matter what they do, they have to interface for resource consenting and all those kinds of things to do that. But Fletcher's and Fulton Hogan and all these other major companies the employees are doing
How much shares does the government have in those major companies?
Well, it's moot because
I heard it was around the 30% mark or something.
Well, individuals hold shares in companies. Corporates hold shares in companies.
No, the government holds shares in companies. That's what they do with pension funds and all of that kind of stuff. They just go and invest it elsewhere. So what I've found, and what Clint Richardson in the United States has found, is done a film called The Corporation Nation. Is that the United States government, and it's starting to appear to me it's a very similar practice to what's going on down here, owns a huge share in the Fortune 500 companies that operate in America, and in a lot of cases over 50%. So what we're talking about is a covert takeover of corporations by the state.
This manifests in a bunch of different ways, Vincent. The fact that we have a number of public meetings that talk about what we need to do as in the repair process, and you see how the technology that's required to fix all this is what you'd almost call the logical equivalent of think big projects. That very large machinery has to come in and plant very large, what are effectively rock piles, right, called stone columns. And what they are is an aggregate metal column, a crushed rock from the river is put into vertical columns up to 20 meters down to reach the remnant alluvial deposits of of what the Canterbury Plains is made out of, and in this case we call them the Riccarton gravels. So wherever those gravels are, we have to go down this far and put these columns of stone that are effectively, we're micro liquefying around those columns by vibrating a hole in the ground and then extracting the water and sediment and then filling it up with a column of stone. Now, there is another technique that can be used to do this, and that is to use H4-treated Pinus radiata, which would last, you know, a couple of millennia. And when I questioned whether that was also a proven technology, there was agreeance that it would work, but he said you'd need five times as many because the Pinus radiata, of course, is a smaller diameter. But I calculated for the repair of one of the suburbs that even if you required five times as many, you would require one-fifth of the investment in the machinery because you could have a smaller plant doing the same job. You could have effectively five times more of them. In other words, the repair would take five times, you know, and I'm just, as they say, doing a napkin calculation in this. But you would employ local people doing this as well. And I think that internalizing what this $20 billion repair is to a community is really the secret to making sure that it heals itself well. But having said that, I also calculated how much land area in forestry you'd need to do this. And for that particular suburb, I worked it out that you'd need around about 5 hectares of Irwell forest. We've got the trees there. They're already there. Putting a treatment plant right next to where you're milling the trees and literally dressing them, H4 treating them, then shipping them to a machine that could just be putting these in. Now, the stone columns can only be put in, takes 48 hours to do one without taking into time the movement of your machinery, the preparation of the ground before and after. But if you could do this with the stone columns at the rate of 48 hours for one, you could do at best 2 a week. And we have to put 20,000 of these things in. Now, do the maths. This is going to take forever.
10,000 weeks?
You're talking, nobody's done the logistics on this. And notwithstanding the fact that the crushing, the movement of this gravel and all the machinery and the carbon credits are going down the toilet.
I just love this. You know, we've got a 10,000 week plan. That's freaking forward thinking, man. Oh my god!
if that isn't a grift, I'll never. You know. Anyway.
Oh my god! I'm sorry. That's just so funny to me.
You've. To hear this being talked about in front of an audience and they're all sort of sucking it up, sort of thinking, oh, well, if this is what we've got to do to prepare the land, I'm glad Sarah's doing it kind of response. Nobody's done the logistics. When I pointed out at this public meeting that you could heal the suburb using H4-treated Pinus radiata, of which you'd get the carbon credits for every ton of carbon you stuck in the ground for two, you know, and I mean, we've got trees that have been in swamps that are 40,000 years old, and we honour how long this timber has lasted for its quality. With H4-treated timber, you could put it in the ground. It's in an anaerobic environment. It could last at least 1,000 years. Now, Christchurch will be inundated by sea level well before that, without question. But the fact that we're not looking at this as a low carbon or a sustainable solution just abhors me. I'm appalled at how small-minded the thinking is on this. If we were to repair this using the trees of Irwell Forest or even Burwood, just let me just take this call and I'll get them to call back. Hello, Blair speaking.
The interesting thing that I find about all these red zone projects is that it makes me start thinking about Agenda 21 and the shock doctrine. It's like a double, triple, quadruple whammy on the local population. Like, first of all, you sever all ties from what you have is independence from the central government, because the central government comes in, wipes out ECANS. It's basically the area of Canterbury's only real independence. And it's only localized power structure that has kind of overall arching power over the rest of the region. And the government can just come in, kick out everybody who's democratically elected there. And then after the Christchurch quake happens, they also pass this sweeping legislation to allow for different building code practices, meaning, i.e., that companies that the government has, like close to a 30% share in, or even allegedly more, might even be less, who knows, like Fulton Hogan and Fletcher's and what have you, they can come in and they can do rebuilding without actual proper council checkovers as normally happens. Like, you normally have to get a whole bunch of council inspectors before you do a modification on your house or anything like that. They're just basically now giving it open slather and calling it an emergency situation to do this to all the houses and all the buildings and anything that these people want to do, demolish or whatever. And it all comes under the whole idea of sustainable development under the Agenda 21 model, which is all of these people who are classified as sustainable developers, i.e. major private corporations that have control over construction projects and what have you, get sweetheart deals from the local government, work with them, do substandard jobs, and force everybody to use and buy that substandard property, substandard buildings, and be happy with it by paying for their substandard government, which they no longer have a say in. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest, Blair Anderson. We'll be right back after the break. Join us in the chat room at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Your last chance to call in, 218-339-8525. That's 218-339-8525. Back in a minute.
Yeah. Yeah. And no one like me. Yeah. 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 Congratulations. You made it. Welcome to the Crusader. It's been a long time coming, yo.
Yeah.
But I'm here now. So what you want to do?
Huh?
How many dudes you really know can flow like this? Like this? Like this? Let's do it. How many dudes you know vote like this? How many dudes you know flow like this? Not many, if any. Not many, if any. How many dudes you know got the skills to go and rock a show?
Welcome
like
back,
this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
I don't know.
This is what Bob Parker listens to when he cruises around in his mayoral limousines with his windows down and his system up, keeping it bangster. Yeah, he got diamonds in the grill. Straight up. Blair Anderson is my guest. For some reason, I've always found it very amusing when you look at, say, the quintessential rapper, you know, covered in bling bling, diamonds in the grill, and the cornrows and what have you, and then you have a look at your politicians and your mayors and stuff like that, and you wonder, it's very strange. Because it's almost as if they're out of place, because they should be looking as blingy and as gangster as the rappers should be. I mean, after all, they probably break as many laws simultaneously as they do. You know, a little bit of equality is what I'm talking about here. Blair, do you have any perspective on that? I mean, do you know any real bad, like, corruption, like, proven that's going on down in Christchurch?
I think the corruption is more institutionalized and thus masked than the sort of outright brazen style. What I do fear is that the developers are sitting in the background of this corporate model of top-down governance, basically saying, you give me this and I'll repair that. and I'll be able to do that because I can make some profit on this. And that approach is prevailing on the basis that, well, unless we do this, we can't fix it.
On a side issue note here, because you know how we're supposed to be the world's perceived least corrupt country in the world? Well, it's because when they send that survey out, New Zealand doesn't actually fill it out. They just sign it and send it back. So because there's no record of any of the corruption that goes on in here, we then become perceived as the least corrupt country in the world. When the fact of the matter is, corruption in New Zealand, as you said, is institutionalized. It's everywhere. Like, corruption runs everything. Everything works normally through corruption in this country. And because it's so normal, nobody notices it.
Well, you're right, and you and I have spoken in the past about the role of things like drug policy and how we perpetuate the idea that we're doing okay with drug policy, whereas in actual fact we do this amongst the worst in the world. If there was ever an indictment of how appallingly bad it is, of course, that we're number one in the world for cannabis consumption. We arrest more people per head of population than any other country on the planet because our police are purportedly so efficient at doing it that they pat themselves on the back every time they do it. You know, the fact that they intrinsically link things like cannabis consumption to deaths on the road when there's no evidence in the science that this is actually a sustainable argument. But no one ever questions it, and that's where I see the corruption. There was a beautiful example occurred just this week, in fact. I'm not sure if you're aware of it, but Sydney, the university and research, medical research people in Sydney have called for 50 volunteers to take Sativex, the well-known UK extract of whole cannabis, to accomplish a research program on how well you can give up cannabis. The universities are saying, oh, look, we can give cannabis to people in a very expensive titrated prescription form to help them get over their addiction to cannabis. And yet there's no evidence that people are really addicted to cannabis other than behaviourally. This is there's no physiological addiction to cannabis, but this is how it's perpetuated, that this says, oh, these individuals are so sick, they need a medicine made out of the very thing that is biting their ass. And yet there's no evidence that it ever bit their ass. That it's a choice that they've made, and that a bit of behavioural therapy would probably get them over the hill better than giving them some magic potion made of the very thing that they're purportedly not supposed to take.
Or how about a new group of friends that don't smoke weed every day with them?
Well, that would, in fact, that's the best advice you can give anybody, Vinny, and that they're really addicted to the process of acquisition rather than in an illicit context. There's the driver to the high rather than the high itself. And that applies, doesn't matter almost which drug of misuse and abuse you look at. The driver is the anticipation. And that's what drives gambling. It's what drives a number of other risk-taking activities. It's not the risk-taking itself. It's the formed intent to risk take that drives the high.
Yeah, and that's why in the Netherlands, when they relaxed the laws on cannabis and allowed for coffee shops, the rate of consumption among the general population went from 1 in 8 to 1 in 21. And a survey was conducted asking those people why they no longer use cannabis. And by and large, they all said the same thing. My social circles changed. All the people that I was smoking with, from time to time or even regularly, after it was legal, I realized that there was no reason to, be in back corners or with people that I didn't really even know these people that well. And the only thing I had in common with them was we were both breaking the law together. And started hanging out with different people. And I didn't really smoke cannabis after that.
And they were no longer living under a cloud of stigma, and marginalised as a consequence. The same thing applied to the ex-Vietnam vets that came home from what was really a torrid and troublesome experience, which many of them were alleviating somewhat benignly, I might add, with cannabis. It was freely available, but also with heroin out of the Burma Triangle, Golden Triangle. When they arrived home, without any medical intervention or psychological intervention, any therapy at all, they just moved back into their communities and they gave up their addictions without any consequence at all. And the research behind that is compelling. It validates exactly what you're saying, that when the circle of friends change, the circumstances or the what in drug parlance is called the set and setting, adjustment is made, then the behaviour changes accordingly.
Well, this is why I get people like you and, all these amazing different guests or whatever. It may not necessarily be because I like you at all or anything like that. It's just because I think you're a better person than I am in some particular ways, and I want to improve myself, and I feel that my life has improved in immense ways simply by your presence.
Well, that's very flattering, Vince. I likewise share the same sentiment. It's lovely to be able to spend time with people that you respect and admire. And I think that should be the aspirational goal of everybody to, as it were, improve their circle of friends.
Yep, indeed. And also, ladies and gentlemen, anybody who's in DC. Today or tomorrow or whatever. Apparently there's a G20 meeting coming into the global economy. So if you're in DC and you want to find the G20 meeting, get on down there. I had a listener email me in talking about that. Also, it's another place where you can also find interesting people to hang out with. At protests, man, there's always heaps of cool people that go to protests. Some of them turn out to be kind of like douchebags who manipulate you and are just there for their own purposes. But on the whole, just like the rest of humanity, 99% really good people, 1% total slimebaggery. But thank you very much, Blair, for coming on and sharing some time with us, mate. And everybody, you should go check out his website, mildgreens.blogspot.com.
That's great. Thank you very much, Vinny. I always enjoy chatting with you. And hello to everybody all over the world that's listening.
Yeah, and we have about maybe 1 minute left, so if you want to leave anybody with some pearls of wisdom, go for your life.
I thoroughly enjoyed the Stephen Harper, the Prime Minister of Canada's comment at the meeting of the American heads of state, in particular those ones from South America, when he said that the drug war's not working. But he couldn't come up with a rational answer as to what would make it work better, because he didn't agree with legalization or any softening of the drug war. All he could do was admit that it wasn't working, which is an insight into the political rhetoric, the blind adherence to failure despite everything else. And, of course, Obama went along with the same acknowledgement, there'll be no change in the status. So we've got a long way to go. There's still a lot of people need some convincing. So get along to those protests and start asserting some moral authority over these people. Tell them they're ning-nongs.
Yeah, indeed. And also give them information as well. I mean, one of the most legendary, most highly decorated cannabis-busting officers in Texas changed his ways and became a pro-cannabis activist after one person just threw an information grenade at him, telling him that cannabis in 10,000 years of recorded usage has not killed a single person. That's why I say information's like a grenade, ladies and gentlemen. Sometimes you just need to throw it in there and walk away. And when it explodes, that person will be all of their minds and ideas will be blown to bits, and you'll have scored one for your side. So keep throwing those grenades in there, ladies and gentlemen, and we'll see you again sometime at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com.